Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Scales of Truth. I'm Tyson Harley. Yeah, I'm using my headphones. I guess I'll use them anyway. We'll see if it's any good or not. So, all right. This is a huge circumstantial. It's totally circumstantial. Totally circumstantial. But it's still a backdrop of possibility and circumstance and probability for Charlie Kirk and even the recent Khomeini murder assassination with their pitbull America on its leash. Israel says, sick 'em. Rather than dealing with a nation state, the way nation states have a right to exist, and you deal with their leadership or you go to war with them, but what you do with nation states and the whole idea of international law is there is diplomacy through the political leadership, the political representatives, or there's war, but you don't get to assassinate. It's literally against the idea of civil order, of even sovereignty, but Israel doesn't do that. Well, I've railed against that recently, but this I didn't know. Rise and kill first. I haven't read it yet, but I've heard someone who's read it on the topic of, if you go listen to a podcast called Solving JFK, very, very good deep dive, recent episodes where sometimes he goes ahead and has a rebuttals discussion with a fellow expert as opposed to just doing his deep dives in the certain areas. And the area he's done recently is Israel. And so he's having the discussions and that. And the guy he's talking to says, you know what never gets brought up here? I mean, it's easy to say for anybody as far as whether or not they actually killed JFK. There's just so many people who could have had the motive, but doesn't mean you can find the underlying perfect evidence for it. By definition, right? It's an old crime. People are trying to hide their crimes. You can't always investigate to the nth degree, let alone when Hoover basically shuts down the investigation because the asshole he is. And so don't do a proper investigation. So anyway, with that, the Solving JFK, the guy says, you know, a lot of people don't talk about this. It's a book called Rise and Kill First. It's deeply, deeply researched. And it goes to the idea of Israel's mindset as a country from the very beginning. And I'm going to get to that. But first, I want you to remember there's a related policy I've mentioned quite a few times. And it is called the Hannibal Doctrine. And the Hannibal Doctrine says, and I'm paraphrasing, if there are hostages, we kill the hostages. We don't have time for this bullshit. We kill the hostage takers and we kill the hostages. It's too bad, so sad. You know, we take the mindset of always being under siege. And so when the hostages die, too bad, so sad. The leverage of the hostage takers goes to zero then. Because they know you won't do anything but kill them if they take hostages. And so they're just going to be dead, so why take hostages? Now, if you're going to go that far and not be, we go in and get our own, right? So think about this. It's the underlying basis of the humanity of even the U.S. armed forces that are supposed to be badasses, right? And they are. But I want you to understand the mindset of we go and get our own. I mean, think of all the old MIA and how if we think the basis for decades of things like the movie Rambo, like we've left somebody in country, POW, MIA, the black flag. We don't do that. You know, we don't do that. We don't leave even one person behind the lines. That's not our policy. That's not our norm. That's not our morals. It's not our ethics. But Israel says, oh, we fucking are. I'm not saying it would necessarily because the excuse of if a troop is behind the line. But even like hostages, while we say we don't negotiate with hostages, we also in no way, shape, or form say, I'm sorry, we don't negotiate with hostage takers. We in no way, shape, or form say we're just going to kill all of them. So think of the vast difference. And before I get to rise and kill first, think about this. Think about the mindset difference of a small, it would almost be like an organized crime family, how you are so extreme. Violence is going to occur and people know not to fuck with you. So it's a, you know, macro version of that, an upsized version of that. But it's more like that, that mindset, but maybe even beyond that, because you think in some sense the organized crime people might say, oh, we're getting our own. We're just going to kill every motherfucker who fucked with us, close or nearby. All of them are going down. We're going in full force. Ain't going to be no justice through the judicial system or through the international courts or whatever it is. They're dead. Kind of like, you know, the overwhelming likelihood, but definitely not something they always do. Of, did you just murder an officer? You better not give us an excuse to be able to fire at you, because you're not going to be killed by one gunshot. You're going to have 35 bullet holes in you. Like, we are going to come with overwhelming force. Okay, so it's even different than organized crime. You'd say, we're going to kill all of you bastards because you took one of ours. You know, motorcycle clubs and the like. It's, we're going to kill all you bastards, and you think you saw something badass when the SEALs came in. Fuck that. You're not only, you better not be wondering what's behind the bush, because we're killing all of you, including the hostages. Think of how overwhelmingly different that is than the rest of the morals and ethics on the planet and the policies. Think of that. That's just the Hannibal Doctrine. So on October 7th, what really happened, and I've said this before, but we're going to get to rise and kill first, because it's an elevation or a reinforcement of the very same idea of extreme approaches that you must think about when you think about anything having to do with Israel that might be relevant to the situation. So the Hannibal Doctrine in Israel, they admit it's used. They admit it was used on October 7th. But for our dumbass on the leash media and political representatives over here, they get to say, oh, well, they took 10 hostages. No. It's not that two hostage takers took 10 hostages. It's that 10 hostages were also murdered by the other side because we bombed all those motherfuckers. Now, that am I saying at all, I am not at all saying that every death on October 7th happened at the hands of the Israelis. Not by any way, shape, or form am I saying that. Hear me. What I am saying is in Israel, the details said a certain number were killed by the enemy. And then they readily admit that some were killed due to the Hannibal Doctrine. It's a known thing over there. And over here, it's, you can hear about it. I mean, obviously, I know about it. But it's not referenced to, it's not cited as a main situation there. And so over here, it's that a larger number is understood to be killed by the enemy because we don't think of the Hannibal Doctrine. So that's that. Now, I'm watching Solving JFK, and the guy points out Rise Up and Kill First, or whatever the name is. Actually, since I'm recording this way, I can make sure that I'm looking at it. So let me make sure of this book. Rise Up and Kill First, I believe is it. Yes, no, Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations by Ronan Bergman. And I'm going to paraphrase here because I heard the guy explain it in paraphrase. Is a JFK expert who said, people don't bring this up. If anything was relevant, this helps color some of the background that it makes it more relevant as to whether Israel may or may not have done JFK, which we truly can't prove. I mean, we might, maybe could have, but right now it's not proven. It's just one of the likely suspects, the usual suspect. So with that, he goes, you need to know about this. And in reality, I'm going to go to the description of the book. In reality, what is happening is that since 1948, give or take, Israel's policy is, if we deem you to be the enemy, we assassinate you. We do not do the international law aspect. We just don't. Of, well, you're the leader. Okay, we paint you as the, doesn't matter whether we paint you, but we might do it for propaganda purposes. We just murder you. There is no, let's negotiate your respected leader of another civilization, of another country. Therefore, we get together, we shake hands, we see if we can work this out. And if we don't, we leave the table and then make war plans. No, then we murder you. Then we murder you. Allah Khomeini. Allah, when I told you in a recent episode that one of the negotiators, I don't remember which country it was for, one day they're at the negotiating table, the next day they're hanging out in another country, and Israel murders them in the other country. A diplomat, all right? So think of the intimidation that can happen when you go, think about this. This is why, in my opinion, the leadership, not the people, not the religion, the leadership is one of the planet's scourges, because you say, I know the civil and proper thing to do with fellow humans is you either say those people who decided to defend your country, now you got to defend your country. You made that willingly. Or you say your leaders are respected, understood, and are not subject to the type of punishment that the people who chose or were conscripted to be in your armed services might be. They're not of the same age. They're not of fighting age. Of course, they're not subject to death at our hands. But if instead you go, fuck yes, they are. Fuck yes, they are. If we decide that you're the enemy, we are going to try to murder you. Period, plain and simple. It doesn't matter if you're in Congress. It doesn't matter if you're a senator. It doesn't matter if you're the leader of the country for the last 30 years, like the Khomeini was. It doesn't matter if you're the leader of a country that's based on religious tenets and you're the respected and understood leader of that culture. We will murder you. We will not merely go to war with your fighting forces. We will murder you from the top down. You understand that? The difference in that, the difference in psychological terrorism, and terrorism is psychological, right? Misusing violence or the threat of violence to intimidate. That's what it is. There's no country on the planet otherwise that has this as an open policy. Okay, so when, and again, it's circumstantial, but Charlie Kirk is pro-Israel, 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 is the leader. The leader of the next generation of religious conservatives in America. The leader of the people who would otherwise think Prince of Peace, Christ is the center, not Old Testament. The leader, like 16 to 25 year olds are like, that's my dude. That's, I'm devoted to God and to Jesus. And this is one of the people who helps me understand that. And helps me frame that. And when he says, I mean, I don't agree with everything Israel's doing. This is ridiculous. At some point, the leader, this is as though the leader of, it's as though he's the one who has American pit bull on the leash. And he goes, nope, don't sick him. American pit bulls, don't sick him. Don't sick. Because this guy's telling me that you should sick American pit bull on leash. And I don't believe you should. And I'm the one who's got you on the leash. So we're not going to sick them. I know that changes the analogy a little bit because I'm talking about the general sentiment of the American people as opposed to the armed forces. But still, there's something to that. Okay, there's something to that. And Charlie Kirk is saying, not everything Israel does is correct and proper and certainly not Christian. They're not even Christians. I am not with them. When he says, they tried to paint me as some bad person because I'm trying to think of, yes, America first and Christians first. Not MEGA, right? And not MIFA. make Israel first again, as if we'd have to do that. Okay, when he starts doing that and then reporting, I couldn't believe it. I go to donors and it's like I'm the worst person ever. Like, this is preposterous. I can't believe it. He is now on the enemy list. What did I just tell you? All right, let's see. Let's see what this one says. Goodreads Choice Award. We're going to read it. Okay, and then who else is on the enemy list? Khomeini. Even if we get sign-off from our idiotic American military on the leash, not the military itself, but the leadership that controls them, to get to use all of their money, because after all, they're just dogs on a leash for us, so who cares, you know, if we make them fight in a pit bull fight and they get killed, it is what it is. There are pit bulls. Okay, if they die, they die. I like George the pit bull, but, you know, we were trying to be entertained or had some motivating goal to use them, and if they kill each other, they kill each other. Who cares? If they use their armory and their inventory and their weapons, and, you know, some of them die, who cares? Just a pit bull on a leash. Who cares? I can train another pit bull. It's no problem. So here we go. The first definitive history, this is off of Goodreads, of the Mossad, Shin Bet, and the IDF's targeted killing programs, from the man hailed by David Remnick as arguably Israel's best investigative reporter. So again, this is by Aronin Bergman, B-E-R-G-M-A-N. So this is an author in Israel. This is not coming from Tyson's Conspiracy Corner. Okay, so I'm just going to read the introductory here, maybe find some others. The Talmud says, if someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. Okay, so when I say Z word, as opposed to average Jew or Judaism, we're talking about the people who are the most fundamental. Find all of their motivations at the most extreme level. And just like a really fundamentalist Christian would, they take it to the nth degree. The Talmud says, if someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. That's not a quote from me. That's a quote from David Remnick, arguably Israel's best investigative reporter. This instinct to take every measure, even the most aggressive, to defend the Jewish people is hardwired into Israel's DNA. From the very beginning of its statehood in 1948, protecting the nation from harm has been the responsibility of its intelligence community and armed services, and there's one weapon in their vast arsenal that they have relied upon to thwart the most serious threats. Targeted assassinations have been used countless times on enemies large and small, sometimes in response to attacks against the Israeli people, and sometimes preemptively. In this page-turning, eye-opening book, journalist and military analyst Ronin Bergman offers a riveting inside account of the targeted killing programs, their successes, their failures, and their moral and political price exacted on the men and women who approved and carried out the missions. Bergman has gained the exceedingly rare cooperation of many current and former members of the Israeli government, including prime ministers Shimon Peres, Ehud Barak, I'm probably saying it wrong, Ariel Sharon, and Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as high-level figures in the country's military and intelligence services, the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, the Mossad, the world's most feared intelligence agency, Sayasadia, I don't know how you say that, the Mossad, within the Mossad, that carries out attacks on the highest value targets. I didn't even know about them. Caesarea. It looks like Caesar and then EA. Caesar. C-A-E-S-A-R-E-A. Caesarea. I've been studying Spanish, so all of a sudden I'm throwing Spanish pronunciations at things. It carries out attacks on the highest value targets. And the Shin Bet. I don't know if that's how you say it, but S-H-I-N, a separate word, B-E-T. An internal security service that implemented the largest targeted assassination campaign ever, in order to stop what had once appeared to be an unstoppable suicide terrorism. Remember, they're behind the whole make the entire company what I want to say, front company to of quote telephones to get them distributed among quote terrorist targets. And then on one day, the explosions inside the explosives inside the telephones went off and killed, I don't know, dozens of targets. So that might be the Shin Bet, I forget. Including never before reported behind the curtain accounts of key operations, and based on hundreds of on the record interviews and thousands of files to which Bergman has gotten exclusive access over his decades of reporting. Rise and Kill brings us deep into the heart of Israel's most secret activities. Bergman traces, from statehood to the present, the gripping events and thorny ethical questions underlying Israel's targeted killing campaign, which has shaped the Israeli nation, the Middle East, and the entire world. So let's see. I'm going to read you the author. Born in 72, grew up in Kiryat Bialik. I don't know how you say that for sure. As a reporter, as a boy, he was a reporter for a youth television show. He studied law at the University of Haifa and graduated cum laude from its law school. A member of the Israeli bar, studied history and international relations at Cambridge, was awarded a master's of philosophy degree, probably, or something degree in international relations, and then a PhD for his dissertation on the Israeli Mossad. Crazy. Absolutely crazy. A winner of the 1995 B'nai B'rith World's Center Award for Journalism and the 1996 Haaretz Award for Best Story. Former senior staff feature writer for Haaretz, Haaretz. Crazy. Absolutely crazy. But it does give you that context. Again, it's circumstantial. But, man, I'm telling you what would you call someone, any country, if I didn't give you a name that said, diplomacy, shlplomacy. If I want to murder this president or this prime minister because I have declared him the enemy, we believe, and this is our policy, that is totally justified. It just shortcuts a lot of trouble. Now, listen, America has done that, right? America has done that. However, they don't tend to murder leaders. We certainly tried, with Castro, and that's and other Central American leaders, but typically we depose them, get them out of the country. But when we're hand in hand with Israel, we sure are good at helping murder leaders. But if I told you there was a country that says, yeah, I know international law and international morals and or ethics are that this area's their leadership is generally organized by the people that more or less represent them or are understood to represent them at this point. And as a country in a region with a right to self-governance, it makes sense that these people have a right to exist as leaders of their people. And so we discuss with those people first before we go to war. But then when and if we decide to go to war, we then try to take the country. We tried to dismantle their infrastructure, but we don't go to the houses of their government and destroy all of their leaders. Israel does. Okay. If I had said that, what would you say about the country? Well, they're bypassing everything that is considered even close to civil, you know, even close to sovereignty. And so you would call that country, in any other context, a country engaging in terror, because the usual, all right, let's put up your fists and duke it out. You know, what is the style? Queensberry? Queensberry rules. Put up your dukes. And we decide to have a fight, a good fight with some rules so we don't go too far. You don't get to stab me with a shiv in the middle of may the best man win. If instead you went, wait a second. We decided that what we do is have our forces go against each other, and then what happens, happens. And then, yes, strategy is all the way in, but we don't then launch a missile at your leader's place. Okay. When there are no Queensberry rules, then you would call that terror. I mean, it's at the highest level of guerrilla warfare, right? Because it's not even really warfare. Because warfare, again, means two sides and their opposing forces going against each other, not going straight to the top and murdering. So, again, circumstantial, but something that you simply cannot pull away as you try pull out of the background understanding and context of the mindset of a killer when they kill or when they might be suspected to kill. You simply can't separate it. You simply can't separate that. Just like the, or, you know, as I said, the Hannibal doctrine. Wait a second, we go in to get ours. They say, we don't. We might sometimes, but we don't have any real reason to. We don't have any underlying principle by which we will die to go get those people. There are no POWMIA. Remember, you could have the, you know, black flags that would say POWMIA. No, because we would have killed the hostage takers. Now, if it happens that we don't know where the veterans are, and they're MIA, and we just haven't solved it, But if we know, they ain't missing an action, we killed them. Okay, that's how it is. Hannibal Doctrine. Totally different mindset that changes the way you analyze. I mean, literally hostage takers have to go, oh, no, no, I might take a hostage against Switzerland. I might take a hostage against Japan. They're not a country that's this extreme, but I'm not going to take a hostage against Israel. That it changes the way the mindset is. Like, if you know that, yeah, I'll steal a 20 from Tyson. He's pretty peaceful. He'll yell at me, and he'll yell really loud because he has a humongously loud outside voice. Yeah, that's annoying, but I'll steal a 20 from him. But I do not steal a damn thing from Jim because he may kill me and my dog and my entire family and go over the top with everything. Like, you do not fuck with Jim, okay? That's a part of the analysis, right? And by the same token, this has to be a part of the analysis with whether or not you're going to deal with Israel or whether how to understand Israel if they're a potential suspect and or just to understand their motivations in a situation. And it should be that every diplomat in America and every leader, as they come to the table, understands, wait a second, these are the same motherfuckers who go, give me an excuse to murder their leader. And if you understand, give me an excuse to murder their leader, then you go, well, their argument for this action may be a little bit less than truthful. And then if one of the first things you do, instead of destroying a nuclear facility, is murder their leader on their behalf, and then you're cheerleading that you freed the Iranian people, and then all of a sudden Trump's like, I think we've done enough for you, don't you think? No, we want to continue the war. Hello? 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 When they go to the bargaining table, and they've already decided Khomeini must die, even though he's led his people for 30 years, and we just hit his facility 6 months ago. And the Americans are like, we need to bargain. Do you think that that's genuine? Are they genuinely bargaining if in the background they have made the decision as an intelligence agency and or leadership in Israel, which I don't even know how you separate the two, if they're this vicious and this aggressive, how do you separate the two? How do you separate Netanyahu from the most vicious aspects of what Mossad would do when you know that this is the type of weapons they have and this is the type of motivation that Netanyahu has? How is it really separate? If you're at the negotiating table, Israel is rather, and you've already decided behind the scenes that, okay, this is an enemy and they should die and they should be assassinated, then the bargaining table is window dressing, bro. And if our diplomats don't understand that, then guess what? Like, dipshit Trump, who should be dealing domestically, and I voted for him, he's going to get sidetracked and be a stupid-ass pit bull using our debt money to bomb desalinization plants. Oh yeah, yeah. No, they'll totally want to. They'll self-organize. And we'll free them. They just need to get rid of the Khomeini. Did you really believe that bullshit? Fucking how? How? How did you believe that? So, just huge. Like, and something I did not know. So again, then, this book is called Rise and Kill First. Rise and Kill First. As a supplement to the Hannibal Doctrine. Holy shit! Let me see if I can, maybe I'll try to read just maybe a couple of reviews here. Maybe I won't. What do you think? I don't know, 5 stars. Let's see what I got here. See if any of them are, and again, I'm not, I got to say it 75 times because, you know, the whole, the A word.
Anti-Semitic.
Because to understand the world and to be critical of things that you see, interestingly, and this is why I give props to the guy who is solving JFK. He said straight up, it's like, well, but if I didn't look at it in all the detail I do as I'm trying to uncover the mob, LBJ, potentially Russia, so on and so forth, then I would be anti-free speech. So it's not that I would be anti-Semitic to cover it. It's that I would be anti-free speech to not cover it. Now, I'm going to cover it in balance and not make an overwhelming decision if I don't think that decision can be made. Let's see. Search review text. Let's see if any of these are... This looks like a... I'm just going to read it. This is good. So I'm going to read it because I don't think this guy has copyright over his review. If he's somehow monitoring the scales of truth. So this is a 5-star. A lot of times reviews will give you a nice little paraphrase. All right. When the state of Israel achieved nationhood in 1948, it was seen as an ethical and moral experiment because of the role of the Holocaust played in its creation, along with its dominant Jewish culture. Residing in a geographical region that had nothing but hatred for the new state, it would be difficult to expect Israel to maintain the high standards that were expected of it. The difficulty would morph into a nation that had to protect itself from invasion, and once that was beaten back, it had to deal with constant attacks across its borders. As a result, Israel would take on the character of other countries and adopt measures that ran counter to expectations. The evolution of Israel into an intelligence and military power to meet the needs of its citizens is explored in detail in Ronan Bergman's new book, Rise and Kill First, Secret History of Israel's Target Assassinations. Bergman is an Israeli journalist who writes for Yedioth Aronath, it's probably pronounced wrong, and has received the highest prize offered for journalism in Israel. Bergman's monograph begins with the end of the Second World War and continues through today. It is based on over 1,000 interviews, thousands of documents, and runs to about 650 pages. What is clear from the outset is that Israeli leaders were firm believers in the Hammurabi Code of an eye for an eye. And as I say, not exaggeratingly, a body for a toenail. But that's not what this reviewer is saying. Going back to the review, this can be seen from the outset as Israel wanted to ethnically cleanse as many Palestinians as possible, plan Dalit. Okay, so I'm going to assume that he's basically characterizing as the book is characterizing and not going to try to, you know, caveat the rest of what's said. So for what it's worth, maybe the book didn't say this, but I'm not going to try to overly caveat as he characterizes in a certain way. So he says that's Plan Dalit. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. It's D-A-L-E-T. From towns in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Bergman traces the creation of a, quote, machine, end quote, which came about through the, quote, marriage of guerrilla warfare and the military might of a technological powerhouse, end quote. Wow. I just used the term guerrilla warfare when I was describing this. Bergman explores the political leaders, operatives, methodology, and deliberations that resulted in many successes, but a number of important failures also. One of the major themes of the book rests on the moral cost of this policy and how two separate legal systems developed in Israel, one for ordinary citizens and one for intelligence, community, and military establishment. You don't fucking say. Huh. The template, it's going to be very, I'm going, this is me now, you know, very similar to, oh, if we call it top secret, then not only does no one come to justice, but how dare you mention it? It would be along those lines. That's why the military, the spy complex, the intelligence complex is so anathema, I always forget how to pronounce that word, to our basic principles and should be abolished. The template became, back to the review now, the template became a model for other countries, particularly the United States after 9/11, which mirrored Israeli intelligence gathering and assassination techniques, which I fucking told you, bro. When we walk hand in hand with a country that does not share our constitutional principles in any way, shape, or form, it fucks us up. And so this is the conclusion this guy's coming to. I'm no journalistic award winner, but I'm telling you, I'm a thinker that puts patterns together. I tell you this shit for a reason. Okay, back to the review. Bergman does an excellent job explaining the Israeli rationalization for targeted killing. He explores in depth the history that preceded its implementation, its legal justification, the resulting bifurcation in Israeli society. Basically, you've got a, and I'm going back to me now, you know, a, if you will, kind of breakaway civilization, but not in the sense that they're making bunkers, but just in a sense that literally this civilization has nothing to do with yours. You will get justice in yours. You will have justice upon you should you do something wrong in yours. In this one, they're above the law. They're the above the law area of the civilization. It's bifurcated. Okay, so back to this, back to the review. Since Israel suffers from a deficit of men and equipment when compared to its enemies, early on they decided to rely on internal security and intelligence gathering services for their survival. The program began under Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, who effectively set up the extrajudicial system to carry out assassinations. So, again, when I pronounce these names, give me a break. By 1949, Ben-Gurion created the Mossad. So the country was created in 47 or 48, so very early on, this was an inherent part. The separate structure was forming separately as part of its inherent structure of the fundamental way that they went about international relations. That's me talking. So I'll start again from where this ended. By 1949, Ben-Gurion created the, or rather where I was, by 1949, Ben-Gurion created the Mossad, covert activities beyond the country's borders, along with the Aman, A-M-A-N, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, the military's intelligence arm that supplies information to the IDF, and at Shin Bet, responsible for internal intelligence, counterterror, and counterespionage. These three services still remain at the core of Israeli intelligence activities to this day. There are a number of key events and individuals that are responsible for the evolution of Israeli attacks. Israel faced Fadayeen, Arab terrorists led by an Egyptian, Mustafa Hafez, who crossed into Israel in great numbers after the War of Independence and killed numerous Israelis. By 1956, the Suez War broke out, and after the Gaza Strip was conquered, Israeli intelligence came across Hafez's list of operatives who had terrorized Israel for years. Ben-Gurion ordered that everyone on the list should be killed, and one by one, operations were carried out. And that to me isn't so bad in that we are talking about one-on-one of an organization. It depends on kind of how you define it. You know, it's the whole thing of, yeah, but do you recognize these people as a country? Have you recognized? And that's where I say, like, the Khomeini assassination a couple weeks ago is beyond the pale, because once you recognize them as a country, you're not saying they're a ragtag group of terrorists, right? All right, so going back to this, Ben-Gurion ordered that everyone on the list should be killed, and one-by-one operations were carried out. This section of the book reads like a Daniel Silva novel. Actually, I have a book by him. From 56 to 67, attacks were drastically reduced as the Arabs realized the price they would pay from Israeli retribution. However, the Egyptians began to employ German scientists to develop long-range missiles. Bergman provides a detailed chapter on the episode, and one realizes that once a threat is perceived, Israel reacts. Okay, that's the threat. Okay, so this is where, when they say, oh, it was about to happen. Was it about to happen? Or is it funny that always you're the preemptive strike? Which also means you're always the attacker, or so often the attacker. Are you spinning the narrative? As I said, you better understand, as an American diplomat, this is the type of lying and deception that I call our intelligence agencies the deception complex, the lying agencies, right? So it's not even really saying it separately. It's just that they're better at it. They're more committed to it, right? So Bergman provides a detailed chapter on the episode, and one realizes that once a threat is perceived, Israel reacts. In this case, the assassination of German scientists, kidnappings, and recruiting certain scientists to be used against Egypt. Ayato Skorzeny, Hitler's operational commander. So understand, under the more civil ways of looking at things, you go, well, yeah, I mean, we're going to get troops. We're not going to try to kill scientists. I mean, those poor guys, they didn't sign up to be in combat. They're just a part of the society's academic areas and scientific complexes. No, we're killing them and we're kidnapping them. And we're going to do operations in that country to kill them. How did that scientist die? Who knows? Oh, his brakes stopped working? Oh, we didn't really look into it. So, I mean, this is in the 50s, I believe. Let's see here. 56, probably in the 50s to 60s. So going back, rereading the catch where I was, and recruiting certain scientists to be used against Egypt, i.e. Otto Skorzeny, or however you might say that, Hitler's operational commander, in German accent, I'm sure it's not said that way. All right, continuing, the book encompasses more than a retelling of numerous targeted killings. Bergman discusses a series of operations whose focal point was not assassination. For example, the hijacking of an Iraqi MiG-21 fighter by getting the pilot to defect, or allying with King Hassan II to spy on Arab leaders, providing intelligence leading up to the Six-Day War. Further, throughout the 50s and 60s, do you understand the tentacle? So, for instance, this is me now after 50s and 60s. We'll get back to it. When you kill a scientist, so again, they hijacked a MiG-21 by getting the pilot to defect. Well, how'd they do that? You understand the persuasion techniques that they're doing individually, one by one in a country as needed. So a scientist's brake lines are cut. He dies downhill because he lives in a city that's hilly. And then they're probably simply gonna bribe or threaten the coroner. That's that. That's the type of thing we're talking about, okay? All right, going back to Israel was with King Hassan II to spy on Arab leaders, providing intelligence leading up to the Six-Day War. Further, throughout the 50s and 60s, Israel was preoccupied by Egyptian President Gamal Nasser. I don't know if it's Gamal or Jamal. And as a result, Israeli intelligence missed the creation in 1964 of the Palestine Liberation Organization under Yasser Arafat and Abu Jihad. After the 1969-67 war, the PLO launched numerous attacks against Israel as Israel attempted to assassinate Arafat. Okay? His popularity among Palestinians increased. Okay, so now this makes sense on some level. The PLO is probably not recognized as an independent, entity, but nonetheless, they go right to assassinating from the top. Not that this is like on the level of Khomeini, who's ruled over Iran since the 90s, but it still just, again, emphasizes the outlook, right? Okay. So going back, as Israel attempted to assassinate Arafat, his popularity among Palestinians increased, and enlistments in the PLO rose dramatically, as a Palestinian leader was seen as the embodiment of Palestinian nationalism. Perhaps one of Bergman's most interesting chapters, Meir Dagan and his expertise. The author describes how Israel dealt with this increasing threat. It is here that we see assassination and killing implemented as standard policy. Standard policy. Standard policy. The Israeli government unleashed Ariel Sharon, who commanded Israel's southern frontier. By the end of 1969, Sharon created a new unit under Meir Dagan. Also, I'm going to say, this is me doing an aside, if you look at some of these Mossad and these type of assassination and killing operations, a surprising number of their leadership, Israel's later political leadership, comes from that background. Surprising versus what you would normally think, but understand for Israel, because of this bifurcation, it makes sense that they're just drawn from them. And as a result, they're drawn from that lying and deception habit. And you cannot pull that away. You can't. I remember Bush Sr., we didn't know at the time, from the very beginning, they're lying and deceptive. None of us knew. That was probably my first election I knew anything about, really, as a young adult. That I'm telling you, nobody knew George Bush Sr. It was never discussed. I was old enough to understand this. I was a young adult. It was never discussed that he was led the CIA. So he comes from lying and deception. That's what he knows. And by the same token, when you have this bifurcation of the society as spoken of here, and you have one side that says, we lie and we deceive and we kill. That's what we do. We must. It's not that we must do the right thing and win. It's that we lie and deceive and kill, and we consider that the right thing to win. Okay, it's a different definition of the right thing to win. And so when it's that much more important in that society, and some decent percentage of their leaders come from that background, then some decent percentage of the leaders, and 100% of them come from that background, come from a background that is based on lying and deceiving in order to carry out the holy goals. Okay, so back to this. By the end of 1969, perhaps one of Bergman's most interesting chapters, Merdagan and His Expertise. The author describes how Israel dealt with this increasing threat. This is a PLO threat. It is here that we see assassination and killing implemented as standard policy. The Israeli government unleashed Ariel Sharon, who commanded Israel's southern frontier. By the end of 1969, Sharon created a new unit under Merdagan, Meirdagan, and using intelligence gathering by the Shin Bet, went into Gaza to murder Palestinian operatives and leaders. After the PLO responded by slaughtering an Israeli family driving along the Gaza Road, Shin Bet and IDF special forces wiped out terrorism in the Gaza Strip through 1972 by employing methods that went beyond Israeli domestic law. This was effective until the Jordanian Civil War produced a new Palestinian terrorist group, Black September. Bergman's command of his material is superb in his analysis down to the last detail. He takes the reader into areas that no previous author has done. Numerous operations are described, including their conception and implementation. Among the many that are discussed include the, quote, Spring of Youth, end quote, operation that resulted in the death of three top PLO officials and 35 PFLP terrorist in Beirut in October 1972. If you remember, the another thing, what was this operation? Yeah, I forget that right now. But when you have people coming in and they're, oh, look, they're just a camera group, the documentarian group. It reminded me of a movie where they talked about that. And I kind of thought there was a movie with major Hollywood actors that talked about, you know, some type of an operation where they were really, you know, killers and or Mossad type operatives, and getting back. And maybe this is what this is talking about. But they were disguised as like a camera documentary group. And it's not that. I'm just not thinking. I feel like there's a movie out there about that type of thing. Anyway, going back to, I think it might be a movie about kind of the response to Olympic Munich massacre. So among the many that are discussed include the Spring of Youth operations that resulted in the death of three top PLO officials and 35 PFLP terrorists in Beirut in October 1972, which netted documents that would lead to the destruction of the Fatah network, F-A-T-A-H, in the West Bank, and the killing of all the assailants related to the 1972 Olympic Munich massacre by elements of Black September. However, as successful as the operation was, it created tremendous hubris, is that how you say it, on the part of Israeli leaders, leading them to believe the Arabs would not attack further. This feeling of superiority resulted in rejection of Anwar Sadat's peace overtures, which led to the outbreak of the Yom Kippur War. Well, I'm going back to me now. Or you can say that, why would we have peace tables when give us an excuse to not have peace so we can murder more of you, and that outlook. Okay, going back to this, I'll reread that part to put in context. This feeling of superiority resulted in rejection of Anwar Sadat's peace overtures, which led to the outbreak of the Yom Kippur War. The Salema operation is described, S-A-L-A, Salame, S-A-L-A-M-E-H, operation is described in detail and produced a number of surprising pieces of information. For example, Salame had been recruited by the CIA and was America's back channel to Arafat. Both parties agreed that the PLO would not launch attacks in the United States and Salame would be protected. However, Israel viewed Salame as the man who engineered the Olympic massacre and waited until January 1979 to kill him with a car bomb in Beirut. So when I say double stabbing in back, this is what I'm talking about. Salame is a known operative. Like, America knows about him. He's important to America, all right? I'm going to restate. Both parties agreed that the PLO would not launch attacks in the United States and Salame would be protected. It doesn't fucking matter if Israel agrees. Do you fucking understand, United States? Do you understand, United States, do you, that when they agree, it is for convenience and perception only? Well, we agree, we'll protect him. He's an important back channel for us to Arafat. Nope, we're going to murder him. So, because Israel, right? Because Israel, that's how they work. Both parties agreed that the PLO would not launch attacks in the United States and Salame would be protected. However, Israel viewed Salame as the man who engineered the Olympic massacre and waited until January 1979 to kill him with a car bomb in Beirut. And again, this is not that the guy didn't deserve retribution if that's the policy that, you know, you're using. It's that you have to understand the United States. They don't give a shit what you think, okay? Get your head out of your ass. And if there's any question that you could go overboard on behalf of the American people or for peace, then don't fucking cooperate with them. Let them do their own shit on their own time with their own money, because likely they're feeding you bad information because they don't care about lying to you. This bifurcation of their society. Fucking wake up. All right. Another example was the Israeli raid on Entebbe? E-N-T-E-B-B-E, that resulted in the rescue of most of the Israeli hostages that were imprisoned after an airline hijacking that was flown to Kenya. Bergman presents the planning of the raid, and once again, the outcome was marked by Israeli hubris. Abu Nidal presented a different problem for Israel after his terror group killed Israel's ambassador to England, Shlomo Argov. This was used as an excuse to invade Lebanon when Israel... So, when I say body for a toenail, this is what we're talking about. I guess it's fine. I mean, we've gone to war when there wasn't even a good connection at all. Of course, that was maybe an Israeli motivated war, the very excuse I use. But okay, so a person gets murdered. That's bad. That's bad. But it's not met by an attack. It's not met by a... a negotiation, like, what the fuck? It's met by an invasion. So, again, I'm going to give the characterization of this review as though the author actually characterized it this way, but I don't know. This was used as an excuse to invade Lebanon. When Israeli attacks led by Meir Dagan failed to provoke a PLO response, a move that Middle East expert Robin Wright led to... I think he means said or characterized as led to Israel's Vietnam. Bergman highlights the most important aspects of the war, especially the role played by Sharon. Okay, so I'm going to read that again or kind of paraphrase it. So an ambassador gets killed. So then they invade Lebanon. Somewhere in there, this exercise is referred to by a Middle East expert as Israel's Vietnam. Bergman highlights the most important aspects of the war. Now I'm going back to reading. Especially the role played by Sharon. The Israeli general had his own agenda in launching the attack. First, to redraw the map of the region with a Christian Lebanon and the movement of Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza to Jordan. Okay, so understand, whenever they talk about Gaza or Lebanon or so on, it's always get those fuckers out of here. Just understand, it always is. It's never what they talk about. Okay, so I'm going to read again. The Israel general had his own agenda in launching the attack. First, to redraw the map of the region with a Christian Lebanon and the movement of Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza to Jordan. And again, this is not coming from Tice's conspiracy corner. It's coming from the guy who's won the highest journalism award in Israel and is an Israeli. Hello? So that was first, redrawing the map of the region with a Christian Lebanon and the movement of Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza to Jordan. Second is obsession with killing Arafat. Both goals were not achieved, but what was achieved was raising Arafat's profile in the Arab world as the Palestinians were forced to leave Lebanon in August 1982, the emergence of a new terrorist group backed by Iran, Hezbollah, and the beginning of an 18-year quagmire in Lebanon. So there you go, the Lebanon quagmire. So that would be kind of 82-ish through about 2000. Sharon acted like a monarch, a law unto himself, making him a detriment to Israel. Sharon overshadowed Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who receded into an emotional depression as the war continued. So this reminds me, and as I said, okay, when Benjamin Netanyahu comes over, I've sarcastically, but in every sarcastic bit of humor, there's a bit of truth. You know, when Vice President Trump makes a decision based on what Netanyahu said in the last 3 weeks since he visited. Okay. And so when I say, you know, Fauci, this is so funny because there's an analogy. When he kind of didn't like it, but Trump's like, what the fuck does, so why is Fauci the president all of a sudden who talks to the country every day? Why is this fucker president? Well, he was, and you fucking let him. You let him. You let him. And then you help fund Operation Warp Speed like a fucking dipshit. So what's the analogy? Well, you've got Prime Minister Menachem Begin, and instead, Sharon is overshadowing him. So here we say again, Sharon acted like a monarch, a law unto himself, making him a detriment to Israel. Sharon overshadowed Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who receded into an emotional depression as the war continued, and was replaced by Prime Minister by Yitzhak Shamir. Israel would continue its policy of targeted killing as the carnage of Munich, Maalot, Naharia, and many others became Israel's justification for murder and summary executions. Lebanon made the situation even worse, as there were no laws to restrain the Shin Bet from torturing prisoners and, on many occasions, killing them. There are numerous other highlights in Bergman's detailed narrative. The Intifada that broke out in December 1987 that caught the Palestinian leadership, Israeli government, and intelligence officials totally flat-footed is a case in point as it eventually morphed into the Oslo Peace Accords of 1993. The Intifada saw Israel double down on targeted killings as it sought to control the images being flashed each day in the media. Israel's main target was Abu Jihad, Arafat's number two man, and Bergman describes how he was hunted down and at the same time missing an opportunity to also kill Mahmoud Abbas, the current president of the Palestinian Authority. Remember, in some cases, the Palestinian Authority was recognized, right? Like nations were recognizing them, and Israel says no, and so we'll kill your leader. A little bit of a gray area in the idea of international law, but again, all the way up to the top. All the way up to the top. Arafat's number two man and Bergman describes how he was hunted down and at the same time missing an opportunity to also kill Mahmoud Abbas, the current president of the Palestinian Authority. Bergman makes the important point that Abu Jihad, who was not as intransigent as many others in Gaza, had been alive perhaps. There might have been some movement towards ending the Intifada. And perhaps, quote, Hamas might not have been able to consolidate its position to dominate large parts of the Palestinian public. So the point there they're making is that when you kill the leaders, you take away diplomacy. You've created a diplomacy vacuum that then could have potentially came to peace accords and the peace table, meaning that you could have stopped murdering people or killing people. The conflict on both sides could have wound down. So that's kind of the point there. Back to it. As the Intifada continued, the Shin Bet became very flexible in its approach to killings, employing disguise to trap suspects, demolishing terrorist homes, and turning Palestinians into spies for Israel. The most important of which was Adnan Yassin, a mid-level activist who dealt with numerous projects in PLO headquarters in Tunis. Once Yassin was turned, he provided valuable information for over 4 years that helped prevent numerous attacks, contribute to a number of important targeted killings. By 1992, Yassin was discovered and executed. Now, that's not me saying, you know, there's spycraft and agents is something that people do. So I'm not trying to say, you know, that's beyond the pale. I'm just reading from this review for background. As Bergman develops his narrative, he integrates the history of the region and the most important historical figures into his text. None is more important than Saddam Hussein and his quest to acquire nuclear weapons. Bergman digs deep and points out that the United States and France were currying Saddam's favor because of his ongoing war with Iran in the 80s. It is surprising to note that the French built a nuclear reactor in Iraq and supplied him with the necessary technology to try and reach his goals. This was due to the ego of Charles de Gaulle, who resented Israel's ignoring his advice in 1967, and from that time, France, a traditional ally, turned against the Jewish state. The Mossad pursued the same approach it had been using against Egyptian scientists and began killing those associated with Iraq's program. So scientist killing. So again, when scientists die, well, I'm not saying there aren't regimes that just don't go around and just kill just scientists who just think they're trying to pursue knowledge, even if it's at the behest of, you know, defense. But one of them that does kill scientists clearly and obviously is Israel. So when scientists go a-dying, all right. The Mossad pursued the same approach it had used against Egyptian scientists and began killing those associated with Iraq's program. Bergman follows Israel's military and intelligence planning that finally led to the Israeli destruction of Iraq's nuclear reactor in 1981. Another important individual that Israeli intelligence has to cope with was Ayatollah Khomeini, whose movement overthrew Israel's ally, Reza Pahlavi, the Iranian monarch in 1979. Khomeini was seen as an existential threat to Israel and eventually fomented trouble throughout the region and helped create and support Hezbollah, the Party of God, during the fighting in Lebanon. This produced another cycle of violence with rockets and raids into northern Israel and Israeli target killings against Hezbollah leaders, particularly Hussein Abbas al-Musawi, who was responsible for many attacks against Israel. He would be replaced by Hassan Nasrallah as Hezbollah's leader in Lebanon. Bergman points out that killing Musawi may have been a mistake for Israel because he was much more liberal when it came to relations with Israel than Nasrallah, who was more of a radical Shiite. So again, then, instead of bargaining table, if you're not totally with us, we're going to kill you. We call you an enemy because we're not totally with you. Then we don't get that, oh my gosh, Gorbachev, you know, type of a go-between that can start to adjust the culture because of his outlook. We don't even get that far because we kill you too, if that was the analogy, right? So had we killed, say, for instance, Gorbachev, instead of going, hey, this guy might be a little bit more along the lines of opening things up, then do the probabilities go up or go way down that the Cold War doesn't end? Do the probabilities go up or way down that the wall falls? Do the probabilities go way up or way down that the former Soviet republics become their own republics? The former Soviet territories and regions become their own separate republics. They go way down because instead of acting like a leader is a diplomat and a leader of a large group that can influence his group and his area, you've killed them, which then makes the surviving group more likely to be extreme. So again, then Bergman points out that killing Massawi may have been a mistake for Israel because he was much more liberal when it came to relations with Israel than Nasrallah, who was more of a radical Shiite. The process continued in dealing with Palestinian terrorism throughout the 1990s. Despite the Oslo Peace Accords, once again, Bergman effectively deals with another cycle of violence. In Gaza, Hamas was a major problem and was responsible for numerous suicide attacks against Israeli civilians. Israel responded once again with an increase in targeted killings. Despite the Oslo Accords, Arafat refused to cooperate with trying to control Hamas. It would cost Prime Minister Shimon Peres his office, and he would be replaced by Benjamin Netanyahu, effectively ending the peace process. Bergman points out that Hamas suicide attacks were designated to end the peace process, and with the arrival of Netanyahu as a prime minister, they achieved their goal. In the large number of operations that Bergman recounts, he is careful to balance successes with failures, i.e. the attempt to kill Khaled Mashal, a Hamas leader in Amman that totally backfired and cost Israel dearly. Another would be the attempt to kill Hezbollah operative Haldun Hayadar that resulted in a deadly ambush for the IDF. These failures, along with the ongoing threats from an enemy that used tactics that Israel never grappled with before, led to the reorganization of intelligence agencies under new leadership, a key of which was Ami Ayalon to head the Shin Bet, and the introduction of new technology, new surveillance techniques, integration of computer systems, a new approach to network analysis, and the use of real-time intelligence hardware and software designed to integrate different services and operational bodies led to a series of success, of which the killing of the Adwala brothers and capturing the Hamas military archive stands out. The advances made by Shin Bet was replicated throughout the entire country. That's a sick there. Bergman correctly argues if these changes had not been implemented, it would have been even more difficult for Israel to deal with the second intifada that broke out in 2000. Bergman discusses the changes in Israeli governments and its impact on, quote, killing strategies, end quote. Netanyahu's government was plagued by charges of corruptions and an increase in suicide bombings, and by May 1999 was replaced by the Labor Party under Ehud Barak, who as a soldier had been a master of special operations. Barak's military lessons did not carry over to the world of politics and diplomacy. He was able to withdraw the IDF from Lebanon, but failed in his approach to Arafat at Camp David in 2000. This failure, in conjunction with Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount, helped touch off a second intifada. The increase in suicide bombings toppled Barak's government and brought to power Sharon as prime minister, leading to an all-out offensive against suicide bombers. With no real strategy to confront events, Israel turned its usual approach, increased assassination. Turned to its usual approach, increased assassinations. All right, actually, I'm just going to go ahead and drop that one for now. It actually goes quite a bit further here, and maybe just from a different point of view, this is going to see if this next one says anything differently here. I'm going to pause on another high-rated review and see what I want to pull out of here. All right, this one's super interesting. This says, the story starts even before the creation of Israel with some remarkable on-the-record interviews with the hitmen and militia fighters, many of them Holocaust survivors, who helped establish the state by targeting British colonial officials and local Arabs in the early 20th century. This is an epic history of the type that few countries get to tell about themselves. Here's another interesting aspect here. I was generally amazed at many of the revelations that Bergman documents, including the fact that the IDF had carried out a wave of deliberate car bombing attacks against Palestinian civilians in Beirut. Okay, what do you think of when you think of Middle Eastern terrorism? You think of those scumbag cockroaches. I mean, that's what you're supposed to believe. Who, and only those people would do car bombings. No, the IDF carried out car bombing attacks in Beirut. Tried to brainwash captured Palestinians to assassinate Arafat, and even blamed assassinations and bombings in Lebanon on fictional Sunni extremist groups. The means used to carry out these operations were often chilling, including the use of gruesome poisons, package bombings, home invasion murders, and other, quote, terroristic, end quote, forms of killing. Let me see what else I want to say there. All right, here's another little spot. Well, it cannot be said that all members of the Israeli military intelligence apparatus had a cavalier attitude towards Arab lives. In general, they definitely have a far greater tolerance for carrying out operations that would kill Arab civilians as opposed to their European or, God forbid, American counterparts. Several high-profile individuals, including Ariel Sharon, Rafael Eitan, and Moshe Yalon, come across as absolute war criminals in the book, unconcerned with the deaths of innocents, and at times utterly relishing it. All right, this passage continues about one of them who comes across as relishing in the deaths of innocents. Talking about, there is a particular touching section where an Amman operative tasked with helping kill the famous PLO commando Abu Jihad, Khalil al-Wazir, laments how much he had come to respect the man he was tracking, describing him as a, quote, model family man and authentic leader, end quote. It turns out that Moshe Yalon, which is one in the group where the guy had just said several folks came across as relishing in the deaths of innocents. It says, it turns out that Moshe Yalon was personally involved in that killing and pumped several bullets into al-Wazir's already dead body in front of his screaming wife, something that he gloats to Bergman about in the book. All right. The history that Bergman recounts also gives a sobering reminder of how common it was for Israelis and Arabs to kill each other in Europe during the 60s and 70s. The fighting has mostly stayed within the Middle East since then. But for a time, assassinations, mostly by Mossad, and hijackings, mostly by Palestinians, were becoming a global phenomenon. Many listed. Let's see here. They do say many of these attacks, including high-profile Hezbollah bombings that killed dozens of IDF soldiers, had been effectively memory-holed until now, in some cases, deliberately. To my point earlier about when this bifurcation of the kind of governance of Israel between this military-industrial class and the rest happens, that the prime minister is more likely to be a leader that's coming from that and more likely to have that attitude. On top of that, this is interesting, it says, the Mossad has historically been tasked, oh, here it was, I was amazed by the fact Mossad and Shin Bet actually act under the direct command of the prime minister and have no parliamentary oversight. The PM himself signs the, quote, red pages, end quote, to authorize assassinations and calls the shots of specific operations. Needless to say that this is a system extremely vulnerable to abuse and wanton behavior, with a small, unaccountable group of people getting to run their own high-powered global killing machine. It's no wonder that former Mossad head Tamir Pardo recently described the agency as a, quote, this is former Mossad head. This is not Tyson's Conspiracy Corner. Former Mossad head Tamir Pardo recently described the agency as, quote, a crime organization with a license. So with that, I kind of meant that to be more of kind of a case in point of understanding Israel as they deal with supposed diplomacy and the like, and just their motivations and their outlook. But I think it's a good overall background with detail there. That review went into quite a lot of detail. So hopefully that helps you out. And if our leaders could read this book, it would be great. Now, supposedly some of the other reviews, as I looked off mic, were saying it might be a little cheerleady. It does tend to read like a novel, so pretty exciting. But overall, a fairly even account, even if it's often maybe simplifies from the Arab side a little bit. Some of the reviews said that probably if he would have had as quarter as much access to the Arab world aspect, the book could have read differently and maybe, you know, more informative, but not in an awful way. Like, overall, pretty clean, evenly handed book written. Sounds like just an outstanding book to read, cover to cover. So done very well. But really, it's the bite-size digestion of the point of the book that's my point. Like, you don't have to read 700 pages to understand that, okay, their outlook is just different. It's just different. And so that should color your understanding of each and every action when you realize this viewpoint is unique among nation states. Its primacy is unique among nation states. It's, you know, internal, what I want to say, unapologetic aspect is unique among nation states. Every state thinks about doing this. Different nation states do it to varying degrees. But as far as just how unapologetic that is, their mission and their outlook, Israel stands alone. Okay, guys, thanks for listening to Scales of Truth. I'm Tyson Harley.